From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's show, a look into the life and mind of Albert Einstein with Walter Isaacson. His new biography, Einstein, His Life and Universe, says Einstein's remarkable scientific achievements are born of an insatiable curiosity and a resistance to constraints, both intellectual and emotional. He explores Einstein's relationship to the tumultuous events of the 20th century and his roles as scientist, father, husband, pacifist, and political activist. Also, critic-at-large John Powers considers the film Children of Men, just out on DVD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Albert Einstein once said that imagination is more important than knowledge. That's a persistent theme of a new biography of Einstein by my guest, Walter Isaacson. His book draws a strong connection between Einstein's path-breaking scientific achievements and his rebellious personality, his resistance to nearly any constraint, emotional or intellectual. Einstein was a German-born Jew whose life was divided between Europe and America, spanning some of the most tumultuous events of modern history: two world wars, the Holocaust, the birth of nuclear weapons, and the Cold War. Isaacson explores Einstein's connection to these sweeping historical events, as well as fascinating details of his personal life, including strained relationships with his wives and sons, and an affair with a Russian spy. Walter Isaacson has been chairman of CNN and managing editor of Time, and currently heads the Aspen Institute, a think tank that explores leadership and policy issues. He's previously written biographies of Henry Kissinger and Benjamin Franklin. His new book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. Well, Walter Isaacson, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like to begin with Einstein's first visit to the United States in 1921. And at this point, he'd spent his whole career in Europe, mostly Germany and Switzerland, and had by this time developed his general theory of relativity. What was the reaction of the American public and press to this visiting scientist?
It was absolutely astonishing. It's something that even a rock star would be salivating about, because here's a guy who had slaved away in anonymity for years, working at a patent office for a while, and finally, in 1919, they prove his theories correct by seeing that the sun is able to bend the light from a star. So he becomes a world celebrity. The New York Times has a headline saying, "Lights all askew in the universe, Einstein proved correct." So he's one of the most famous people on the planet, and he comes to America to help raise money for a Hebrew university in Jerusalem and to help with the Palestinian settlements there, but also just to celebrate the joy of science. And there are parades for him when he comes to New York. When he goes through the Midwest, they close down all the stores, ticker tape. President Harding meets with him in the White House and talks about relativity. The Senate debates his theories. Only in America could you have something so wondrous as this.
You know, this is a question maybe more about American culture than about Einstein the man, but what accounts for this nation, which of course had a lot fewer college-educated people then than today, what accounts for their fascination with this guy who'd developed this theory, which was so hard to grasp for most people?
In some ways, it was because the theory was not all that hard to grasp. It was sort of a huh, but then you go, wow. You mean gravity is able to bend light beams? You mean that energy and mass are both just different components of the same thing and you could release a lot of energy? And time slows down if you're moving real fast? All of those things were things you could visualize, that you could see. Plus, we had gone through a horrible world war of Germany versus the United States and Britain, and here was a German scientist who had been proven right by an English astronomer, and it was a symbol of both world peace and the joy of science, and the joy of science that you could picture, you could visualize, that people could even discuss and debate and explain to each other.
Now, let's talk about young Einstein. I mean, you describe him as a kid that I think today a lot of middle-class parents probably would have toted to a child psychologist for a consultation. What was he like as a kid?
Well, the good news for all of us parents is that Albert Einstein was no Einstein when he was a kid. He was very slow in learning how to talk, and even after he did talk, he had sort of quirks in his verbal ability that the maid called him de Derpite, the dopey one in the family. And he was such a rebel that he gets kicked out of school for defying authority, and another headmaster gets to amuse history by saying he'll never amount to much and stuff. But it was partly that ability to think in pictures and that rebellious, imaginative, creative streak in him that makes him such a genius, because he was not smarter than the other physicists of the time, but he was more creative.
Right. He had an ability to kind of stretch his vision. You write that he had a mild form of, if I can say this correctly, echolalia?
Well, echolalia, he would repeat sentences to himself silently until he could get them right and then say them out loud, which is why he was so slow in his verbal ability. But in terms of picturing things, when he's age six, his father gives him a compass. Now, you and I probably remember getting a compass when we were a kid, but it doesn't blow us away. For Einstein, his hands tremble, he says, as he marvels at why does that needle keep doing this when nothing's pushing on it? And the notion that underneath all these things that are visible is some unseen forces stays with him the rest of his life. And even a few years later, he tries to picture what would it be like to ride alongside a light beam. How would the light waves look if you tried to catch up with it? And he couldn't figure it out. He said he would go away in anxiety with sweaty palms. But it was this ability to marvel at almost mundane things and look at pictures in a whole new way.
So while you or I might be amused that the needle always returns north, he would be obsessed by unlocking the forces that keep it there.
And he was so obsessed that for the rest of his life, he deals with the notion of field theories. That's all relativity is the forces, the field theories, the general theory of relativity that ties in electromagnetism, and he tries to do it with gravity and stuff. And even to his dying day, he's trying to get the unified field theory. He's on his deathbed, and he's asking for his papers, writing more and more lines of equations, trying to figure out what are those field theories, those hidden forces in the universe that account for everything.
You know, Einstein lived a long time. He was born in,
1879?
Right, and then lived, I guess, until in his 80s. But
in 1955 in Princeton, he died.
But what's remarkable is that most of his most scientifically productive years were when he was younger, when he didn't even have an academic job, couldn't find one, and was working in the Swiss patent office. I mean, how could a man of his genius and insight not be able to get an academic job?
Well, first of all, he graduates from the Zurich Polytechnic, and he's alienated all three of his major professors because he has such a sort of impertinence when it comes to authority that none of them would recommend him for a job. So he's the only person in his class at the Zurich Polytech who doesn't get an academic job and can't get any job. He's trying to get a job as a tutor, trying to get a job teaching high school. Finally, a friend gets him a job as a third-class examiner in the Swiss patent office. But lest we feel sorry for him, I am convinced, and Einstein was as well, that part of his genius came from the fact that he wasn't immersed in the academy at a university being an acolyte to other professors, but he was looking at patent applications. People who had theories about how to synchronize clocks, for example, because that's what they were doing in Switzerland. Being Swiss, they were kind of obsessed with synchronizing their clocks, and so they were using, you know, signals and radio signals and light signals so that the clocks in one town could be synchronized with another. And he's looking down at the train station below with all the trains coming in. And this is how he helps him develop this theory of relativity, that if you're moving, you'll never catch up with the speed of light. And therefore, somebody moving, time will go a little bit more slowly than it will for somebody who's at rest relative to the person looking at the clocks and stuff. So all of these things, in some ways, are a mix of just taking very practical things and trying to figure out the underlying theories. And he loved working in the patent office. His best friend, Michele Besso, he gets him a job at the patent office. They walk to work, and it's with Michele Besso, the only person in the special relativity paper who he gives credit to. He says he wants to thank, you know, his friend Besso for helping him with this breakthrough, because they walk to work each day, and they talk about the patent applications and the underlying physical theories.
So it was in 1905 when Einstein, you know, had a working full-time as a patent clerk, comes up with this brilliant set of papers, which really kind of revolutionizes physics as it stood at the time. I know there's a lot to it, and it's a little complicated, but what did he tell the world that it didn't know then?
In 1905, he's sitting there on the stool in the patent office working 6 days a week, watching the trains come in and out of the station. In his spare time, he's writing papers and trying to get them published. And his first paper is truly revolutionary. It says, light is not only a wave, but it comes in particles that we now call quanta. And that sets the stage for all of quantum theory, one of the great theories of the 20th century. His second paper is a determination of the size of atoms. And this is when many scientists didn't even believe atoms existed. But he found a way to measure the size of atoms and molecules. Then he does another paper that explains Brownian motion, which is why particles in suspended in liquid, why they jiggle. And it's this statistical analysis of atoms and molecules hitting these particles. And he explains it. And then finally he does a paper in which it occurs to him that Newton is wrong. Time and space aren't absolute. And that as you're moving, time is different for you than somebody who's not moving with you. And that's the special theory of relativity. After he does these four papers, he takes a little bit of a vacation, and something occurs to him that's really an outgrowth of the special relativity paper. So he sends a little addendum into the magazine. He says, oh, by the way, speaking of special relativity, something's occurred to me. There's a relationship between energy and mass. And the equation that describes that is E equals mc squared. So he produces the most famous equation in all of physics, and he's still just a patent clerk.
And how did the scientific world react to these papers from the patent clerk?
Well, generally with a yawn, as you might expect, a patent clerk who hadn't earned a doctorate who's trying to publish little papers saying that Newton's wrong about space and time. Nowadays, you know, it's a shame. Nowadays, he probably couldn't have even gotten them published. People thought he was a crank or something. But he gets them published, and generally they're not noticed. But one person does notice, and fortunately it's the most important person who can possibly notice, which is the guy who, at least up until that moment, had been the greatest physicist in all of the world, Max Planck. And he reads these papers, and he sends an assistant down to find this guy. The guy thinks he's at the University of Zurich and is kind of surprised to find that he's actually at a patent office and stuff. And eventually, it takes a while. I mean, not until 1909 is he even offered an academic job. So even 3 or 4 years after he's written those papers, even though a couple people like Max Planck think, well, there's something here, most of the academic world wasn't even willing to make him an assistant professor.
My guest is biographer Walter Isaacson. His new book is Einstein, His Life and the Universe. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is biographer Walter Isaacson. His latest book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. By 1915, he comes up with the general theory of relativity, and I tread with some caution in the science here, but explain what that is and how it's different from the special theory of relativity he developed before.
Well, it's the most elegant theory in all of science. And the special theory is called the special theory because it deals only with uniform motion. If you're on a train or a plane that's moving at uniform speed or velocity, then everything is relative. And it doesn't include accelerated motion. And also, it seems to conflict with the theory of gravity that Newton had, that things happen instantaneously. So he wants to generalize it, to make it apply to all motion, and he wants to tie it into gravity. And he comes up again with a wonderful picture thought experiment. Not a whole lot of math here. It's just if you're in an elevator and there's no windows and you're in outer space where there's no gravity, but you're accelerating upward real fast, you'll be pushed to the floor and you'll feel as if there's gravity. If you take a penny out of your pocket and let it go, it'll fall to the floor at an accelerating rate if you're in that upwardly accelerating elevator, just as it would if you were, you know, sitting still on the surface of the Earth with the gravity pulling it down. And so he says acceleration and gravity are equivalent in their effects. He calls it the equivalence theory. And what he does is he realizes that just like that magnet needle, it's all part of a field. And that's what gravity is. It's not what Newton said, which is some spooky force that acts instantly at a distance. And once again, he has a thought experiment. You know, imagine a bowling ball and you roll it on the fabric of a trampoline. And then imagine you roll a couple of billiard balls right after it. The billiard balls will curve towards the bowling ball, not because of some force the bowling ball does, but because the bowling ball curves the fabric of the trampoline. And what he said was, all gravity is when huge objects curve the entire fabric of space. Now, that's a little bit more complicated than curving a trampoline fabric, but we can sort of picture it. And certainly since he was Einstein and we aren't, he could sort of picture it very well about curving all of space so that if you're a massive object, smaller objects will sort of bend towards you just like the billiard balls will on a trampoline fabric.
And then, of course, he employed sophisticated mathematics to work out the details.
Well, you know, the real triumph. And he never loved math when he was in college. He didn't do that well in geometry. He thought math was something other people could figure out once he did the theories. But finally, when he's doing relativity, he goes to his friend Marcel Grossman, who used to take notes for him when they were in college together in math classes, and says, Grossman, you've got to help me or I'll go mad. I need some math to describe how the fabric of space curves. And he said, well, what you need is sort of a geometry. It's called a Riemann geometry, where it talks about how surfaces curve and the math to describe curving surfaces. And he's in a race by 1915, because everybody knows the general outlines of his theory of general relativity, how space is curved. But there's a mathematician in Germany named David Hilbert who is coming up with the equations and trying to beat Einstein to come up with the exact right equations. And in the end, they basically tie each other. By the end of 1915, they both come up with the equations. But Hilbert says, anyway, it's Einstein's theory. I just helped a little bit with some of the math equations.
And in 1919, we have an occasion where this groundbreaking theory is actually put to an empirical test at among the most dramatic of all events, an eclipse of the sun, right?
The most dramatic of all events and a great dramatic test. If you imagine that curving of space, that is general relativity and gravity, Einstein says, if that's true, the light, a light beam, will be curved as it goes through a gravitational field. And he said, and if you want to prove it right, here's what my equations say. The light from a distant star as it goes right next to the sun will bend by about 1.7 arc seconds, which is, you know, less than a degree, but it's measurable. But the only way to see that, of course, is during an eclipse, because you can't look at the stars on the other side of the sun, you know, without an eclipse. But when the eclipse happens, you see the stars. And if you take pictures of them right before the eclipse, when they're a little bit further away, and then when the eclipse happens, you can see if they're apparently been moved by a tiny bit. And that's just because the light has been deflected when they go by the sun. So you have Sir Arthur Eddington, this wonderful British Quaker, right at the end of World War I, trying to help world peace by saying, if a British pacifist Quaker can prove right the theory of a German Jew right at the end of World War I, so he sails off to this island of Principe in the mid-Atlantic and photographs the eclipse and then comes back to the Royal Academy in one of the most dramatic moments in all of science. And they look up at the picture of Isaac Newton on the wall of the Royal Academy in London and say, you know, forgive us, Sir Isaac, we have revised your universe. Einstein's theory is correct.
It's interesting that around this time there's a turning point of another kind in the arc of his life, as you describe it. He's 40 years old. He's developed what many have called one of the most astounding scientific breakthroughs in the history of knowledge. Around this time, Niels Bohr is developing quantum theory, which Einstein remains skeptical of the rest of his life. And you say that really after age 40, he was far less productive and innovative than he was in his first four decades. Why?
Well, one of the things about his first four decades is he was a rebel. He defied authority. And then he becomes an authority, and he laments it. He says, God has punished me for my contempt for authority by making me an authority myself. So he's protecting the old order. And what's particularly ironic is one of those 1905 papers was a basic foundation of quantum theory, the notion that light is both wave and particle. And he knows that even in 1905, that he's undermining. He says that's the most revolutionary of all my papers because it's undermining classic determinism. But he believes that it just can't be true, all this uncertainty that is inherent in quantum mechanics. And he keeps saying, I can't believe that God would play dice with the universe, by which he means, I can't believe things happen by chance, that there isn't a strict causality or determinism that does things. And it was partly that, as a child, that notion that there's an underlying harmony waiting to be discovered. He just never got his mind around quantum mechanics. And those very last equations on his deathbed for a unified field theory, that was his way to try to overcome quantum mechanics, which he just thought was incomplete.
And in effect, he spends his last decades in this quest for a unifying field theory, something which would seem to explain all of the forces at work in the universe, right?
Well, yes, and, you know, we can say it was a waste of time because he never really added much during that quest to the foundations of physics. But I think we probably ought to wait a century before we pass judgment. I mean, on this show, people like Brian Greene, who do string theory, and people who do loop quantum gravity, they're engaged in the same quest to try to find a theory of everything. And Einstein, when people sort of said, why are you wasting your time doing this? He said, because I can afford to. I've already been famous. I've already been successful. Younger scientists may not be able to pursue these things, but I feel it's part of my destiny to try to understand those laws and magic that are underneath the forces of the universe.
Walter Isaacson's new book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of Necessary Sins, a memoir by Lynn Darling about marriage loss and the many lessons that can be taught by love. From the Joyce Foundation, supporting efforts to educate America's workforce and improve the quality of teaching in low-achieving schools, joycefdn.org. And from the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Albert Einstein's family life and his relationship to Judaism. More with his biographer, Walter Isaacson. Also, critic at large John Powers watches Children of Men. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest is biographer Walter Isaacson, whose latest work is an account of Albert Einstein's personal life and scientific achievements. Isaacson argues the two are connected, that Einstein's brilliance as a physicist stemmed from a rebellious personality that allowed him to defy convention and examine scientific mysteries in original ways. Isaacson's book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. Einstein grew up Jewish in a suburb of Munich, attending a Catholic school. What was his relationship to Judaism as a youth?
Well, for a while, he's in a very secular family. His parents name him Albert because his grandfather was Abraham, but they thought the name Abraham was too Jewish. And they thought they were being assimilated into the German society they liked. Now, of course, that turns out to be untrue, as we know from our 20th century history. But they were among the Jews of southern Germany who thought of themselves as secular and very German. Einstein, very interestingly, at age 9, 10, 11, becomes very religious for a while, immerses himself in Jewish ritual. But then he reacts against it for a while, because after he reads Science, and he said, that helped me form my sort of allergies to dogma and to received wisdom. But even out of that religious period, even though he doesn't keep practicing his Jewish religion, he feels two things. First of all, he's always a believer in God. He does believe in sort of an impersonal God whose fingerprints are there to be seen in the creation of the universe. Secondly, he feels a deep kinship to the Jewish people. He calls them his tribal companions. And throughout his life, he's very interested in Jewish causes, Jewish refugees, resettling of refugees, the foundation of the State of Israel. And he, even as anti-Semitism is welling up in Germany, instead of trying to move away from his Jewishness, it makes him more proud of his heritage.
He, of course, he moved from Germany to study in Switzerland, actually renounced his German citizenship as a youth, and then as he became a celebrated scholar, returned to Germany to study and was there as Nazism arose in the early 30s. How did he end up in the United States?
Well, he does run away from Germany as a kid because he really rejects the authoritarian Prussian attitudes. He's finally lured back, as you say, to be a professor in Berlin, which is the center of theoretical physics. But as Nazism is growing and growing, at this point, he's a world celebrity. He's touring the United States again, visiting professor at Caltech, been invited to the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton. And he happens to be in the United States in March of 1933 when Hitler takes power. And Einstein is denounced by all the Nazis in Germany as Jewish science, and that is too theoretical. And so he knows he can't go back to Germany. So he never returns to Germany and eventually settles later that year in 1933 at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton. And once he settles in Princeton, he never moves anywhere else.
He really came to love and admire America, right?
He loved America for its freedoms, and he fought for American freedoms. He had a pretty simple philosophical set of equations about life, which is all that really matters in producing things is being creative and being imaginative. And in order to be creative and imaginative, you have to be free thinking. You have to have the freedom of thought and speech. And societies that repress free thought will never have creative and imaginative people. And so he fought for free thought, free ideas, and free minds. And that meant he stood up against Hitler, and he stood up against Nazism, and then against Stalinism and communism, even though he was on the left in his political philosophy and a socialist at heart. But he couldn't be a full-fledged socialist because he didn't like state control, and he really hated centralized authority. And then he stands up against McCarthyism and everything else. And he just is always unwavering in this sense that free minds, free thoughts, and free speech lead to great creative societies.
You know, if you look at the span of his life, I mean, he really lives through these tremendously tumultuous events of the 20th century. He was in Germany when World War One broke out. How did he respond to the outbreak of World War One?
He became a pacifist. He, as I said, really hated German militarism. all the professors in Berlin, including the great Max Planck, and including Fritz Haber, who was Jewish but tried to, you know, convert to Christianity and, you know, remain very loyal to the Germans, are all signing on the war effort. They're signing manifestos supporting Germany during the war. And Einstein becomes a pacifist, opposes Germany's World War I efforts. And in some ways, he's shunned. But, of course, it's happening, you know, right as he's developing general relativity. And so they know he's the greatest genius in their midst, but also they're a little bit worried about his pacifist policies. He revises his notion of pacifism after Hitler takes power. And everybody thinks he's going to remain a pacifist. And he's revered in America by the pacifist community and in Europe. But he says, no, no, no. I've revised my political theories because I have new evidence. And when a Hitler comes to power, you can't just be a pure pacifist. You have to take up the possibility that you're going to defend against a Hitler. So he's the one who writes the letter to Franklin Roosevelt warning about the possibility of building an atom bomb.
The possibility that the Germans will be working on an atom bomb, right?
Well, he says, you know, with a chain reaction possible, German scientists may be taking the uranium out of the Congo. They may be doing this. In the United States, he's in the U.S. by this point, it's 1939, we have to start a project of our own to develop a bomb because Hitler may be developing a bomb. Which, particularly ironic, given his love of free speech and free thought, is that J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, the beginning of the Red Scares, even back then in 1939, they considered him too much of a security risk. So he's not actually allowed to work on the Manhattan Project, even though it pretty much got its launch by the letter that Einstein sent to Roosevelt.
So it's interesting that in the popular mind, Einstein, I think, was associated with very much with the development of atomic and nuclear weapons. Right? Wasn't there a Time magazine cover with his head and the mushroom
cloud? Yeah, you know, there's a wonderful Time magazine cover of a painting of Einstein and the mushroom cloud of the nuclear bomb behind him and the letters E equals MC squared written on the mushroom cloud. And it's actually written by James Agee, so it's just a truly wonderfully written cover story. And in the public mind, here's the guy who wrote the letter to Franklin Roosevelt explaining that a bomb might be possible and warning that Germany may do it. And the underlying theory that from mass, if you release it, you can get energy, he was associated with it. But he never actually worked on the Manhattan Project. And certainly right after the bomb is used, he's feeling guilty in a way or feeling very mixed emotions. And so he becomes one of the leaders of the nuclear weapons control movement and those sort of world peace movements to try to stop another use of the atom bomb.
And his theory essentially was that you needed some supranational authority to take control of these destructive weapons, right?
He believed in a world government, federalism, he said, which is the UN wasn't powerful enough. You had to have some authority that really controlled all nuclear weapons so that different nations didn't get involved in an arms race. And of course, most people by the 1950s thought that was incredibly naive. And in some ways, probably it was a bit naive. And when he was accused of being naive, he said, you know, how do you think World War III will be fought? He said, I don't know how World War III will be fought, but I do know how World War IV will be fought. It'll be fought with sticks and rocks. So in some ways, he was much more realistic than some of the people accused him of being naive.
So Einstein is in America after World War II, when anti-communist hysteria gradually grips the country. How did he react to it? Was he tainted by it?
Well, yes. I mean, the FBI compiles a huge dossier on Albert Einstein, all the people who thought because he was involved with pacifist movements that he must be secretly pro-communist and stuff. They never found anything. Those files, I've gone through them all. Many people have. There was nothing. He was, you know, never visited Russia, was not, you know, pro-communist and stuff. But his loyalty was questioned. He wasn't really allowed to be given military secrets during World War II. His friend J. Robert Oppenheimer, who was with him at the Institute for Advanced Studies, famously had his security clearance revoked. And Einstein just stood up for all the people attacked by McCarthyism. He would speak out. He would write letters. He would say, the thing that makes America great is its freedoms. For goodness sake, don't sacrifice the freedoms out of some unwarranted fears.
He wrote a letter asking for, I guess not clemency, but to at least spare the lives of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, right, after they were convicted
of
spying for
the
Russians.
Yeah, he did it quietly, that letter, because he probably thought Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were guilty of some of the espionage charges. But he said, we really want to reduce the hysteria. And so executing them won't help. He asked for clemency. He also, writes letters for just, average professors who were called in front of the McCarthy hearings, saying that the ability to teach freely is an important part of what America is like. He told J. Robert Oppenheimer, just give up your security clearance. Just don't even fight it. Just don't even take the Fifth Amendment. Just talk about the First Amendment, which is I'm allowed to say whatever I want to say, because that's what a free country is all about.
And one of the most fascinating things that I read in your book was that throughout all of this, I guess the FBI never realized that he had an affair with a Russian spy.
Yes, right, exactly. I don't think he didn't know it was a Russian spy. And the Russian spy, she wanted him to visit Russia. She wanted him to come to the embassy. She wanted him to do things. And, of course, he never did. He never visited Russia. But his wife had died, his second wife had died at that point. And he had this romance with her. They went out to Long Island together and stuff. So it never amounted to too much, but it does show that with all the tens of thousands of documents that the FBI collected on him, they missed the fact that he actually had an affair with a Russian spy.
Walter Isaacson's new biography of Albert Einstein is called Einstein, His Life and Universe. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Walter Isaacson. He is a biographer whose new book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. We should talk some about Einstein's fascinating personal and family life. His first marriage was to a Serbian physics student, Milivoje Marić. Do I have it? Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yeah, Milivoje Marić was a brooding, sensitive physics student who had conquered all of the hurdles, or almost all of them, that were standing in the way of women who wanted to go into physics and math. She's the only person, a woman allowed into the Zagreb Academy, and finally gets to the Zurich Polytech, and the only woman in Einstein's class. And Einstein falls madly in love with her, to the horror of most of his friends and his family, because she had a limp. She was, certainly not beautiful, but it was a love affair of the mind. They have an illegitimate child that they give up for adoption. They have a torrid romance, and they write these wonderful love letters to each other. And she helps Einstein with the 1905 papers, checking his math and serving as a sounding board.
And they marry and have two children.
They marry, have two children, Hans Albert and Edward, and then they start drifting apart. Einstein, drifts apart from his wife. He's very cold and callous to her after a while. She is cold and, depressive and everything else, and they want to get a divorce. Einstein can't possibly afford a divorce. They have these two kids. He's barely able to get academic jobs, by 1909 or so, but, not making any money. And he says to her finally, here's a deal I'll offer you. One of these days, one of those 1905 papers is going to win the Nobel Prize. If you give me a divorce, I will give you the money when it wins the Nobel Prize. Now, she takes a week to try to calculate the odds and thinks about it, gets a lawyer to draw up the deal, and she accepts the deal. Now, of course, it's not until 1922 that he finally wins the Nobel Prize, after they've finally seen the bending of light and everything else and proven him right. And she collects and buys three apartment buildings in Zurich.
And then, just to keep things simple, he ends up marrying a cousin.
He marries his first cousin, Elsa, Well, you know, it's to make the book more exciting that you have a sort of soap opera in the middle of physics. But it is a wonderful soap opera, and Elsa is a lot cleverer than she puts on, but she's certainly no scientist and certainly no rocket scientist. And she's a very nurturing, slightly older, good cook, tends to mother Einstein and take care of him. And they have a solid, not very passionate after a while, but still solid relationship. And he finally reconciles himself with his two sons. Hans Albert moves over to America with him. So things get better in the end. But during that period, while he's doing general relativity and winning the Nobel Prize, his personal life is something that would shock the writer of a daytime soap opera.
What's fascinating to me about the Einstein that emerges as I read this book is we see him, particularly after he comes to the United States, is this kind, humble man walking through the Princeton campus, never taken with his own fame or status. A mensch, I mean, to use the Yiddish term, just seems like a wonderfully decent person with those whom he is not so close to. But his relationships of intimacy are never easy. I mean, the marriages and the difficulties with his older son, Hans Albert. What do you think accounts for this?
Yeah, well, he had a love of humanity and a genial quality that made everybody around him sort of adore him. But when it came very close to the inner chambers of the heart, there was always, he resisted any commitments or bonds. It was part of his nature and personality to resist anything that may seem like convention in tying him. So that made him difficult sometimes with the people close to him. But by the time he's settled in Princeton, he's pretty much reconciled with everybody, you know, his family, even his first wife. And he is a mensch, as you say, walking through Princeton. Kids come up and ask for help with their math homework and give him brownies if he's going to help with the homework, and he does it. Some poor journalism student at Princeton High School is flunking, and the teacher says anybody who gets an interview with Albert Einstein will get an A, and so Einstein gives the kid an interview. So Einstein becomes the kindly old guy when the trick-or-treaters come around. He takes out his violin and plays songs for them, and he's, you know, one of the great things, you go to Princeton, everybody tells you the tale of, yes, my father told me once he saw Einstein walking on the street and Einstein explained some math problem to him.
You know, Einstein outlived his second wife, Elsa, and when he eventually died, he was quickly cremated as he'd instructed. But you have to tell us this bizarre story of what happened to his brain.
Well, you know, he's a humble guy. He did not want to be an icon. He didn't want to have a big grave or a huge funeral, so he gets cremated. But this pathologist at the Princeton Hospital, Thomas Harvey, sort of a sweet, spacey pathologist, decides to keep his brain and puts it in a Tupperware container in a Costa-Cola cooler, a red cooler. And Einstein's son, who's around, Hans Albert, and they're all, you know, grieving for Albert Einstein, when he finds out, the next day at Princeton School, the teacher says, anybody know some news? And one girl raises her hand and said, yes, Albert Einstein died. And the teacher says, that's right. Then some kid in the back of the class who doesn't usually talk raises his hand and says, and my dad's got his brain. And everybody, you know, is shocked. But when it comes out that this pathologist is taking the brain, nobody knew who had the rights to the brain. And this pathologist sort of kept it for, you know, I think 30 years or so, driving around with it and keeping it and letting researchers look at parts of it. It's sort of macabre, but it's, you know, it's part of that whole amazing life of, even after his life, Albert Einstein continues to be fascinating.
You know, people think of, you know, Einstein is a metaphor for kind of unachievable brilliance. I mean, impossible genius. What do you think of that view of him and his work?
I think the great thing to realize is that Einstein wasn't, say, smarter than Max Planck or Lorentz or some of the other people at the time of Poincaré, all these mathematicians. But he could think more creatively. He was more willing to think out of the box, to use a cliche, to think, well, maybe we don't have to be boxed in by what Newton said about space and time. So it wasn't he had some unattainable intelligence. It was that he was a little bit more creative, more willing to defy convention, and to think a little bit differently from everybody else.
Well, Walter Isaacson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It was really a pleasure.
Biographer Walter Isaacson. His new book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. Coming up, John Powers on the film Children of Men. This is Fresh Air. Alfonso Cuarón's post-apocalyptic thriller Children of Men opened last Christmas during a flurry of movie releases. It's now out on DVD, and critic John Power says it may well be remembered long after last year's big hits are forgotten.
A couple of Saturdays ago, I spent 9 hours watching The Coast of Utopia, Tom Stoppard's theatrical trilogy about 19th-century Russian intellectuals. Mired in a backward, tyrannical country, these characters dreamed of creating a free and equal society. And what struck me about watching them is how astonishingly old-fashioned they now seem. Although most people in the world are freer and more prosperous than ever before, today's imagination is obsessed with dystopia, society as an oppressive hell. There's no more striking example of this than Children of Men, just out on DVD. Set in a near future that seems terribly familiar, Alfonso Cuarón's movie offers a thrilling and harrowing vision of modern society as a war zone. The year is 2027, and most of the world is post-apocalyptic. Mushroom clouds have bloomed over the major cities. The Siege of Seattle is in its 1,000th day. But Britain goes on, a nation filled with terrorist bombs, soldiers guarding the streets, and camps filled with refugees known as Fugees. And here's the really bad news. Women throughout the world have stopped bearing children. There hasn't been a baby for nearly 20 years. Nobody feels the despair of all this more than Theo, played by Clive Owen. Theo's a dead-eyed, burnt-out case until he's grabbed by a rebel group, the Fishes, led by his ex-wife. That's Julianne Moore. She wants him to smuggle a young black fugitive named Key out of the country. Key's very special, you see. She's pregnant. Of course, getting Key to freedom won't be easy, and the first thing to be said about Children of Men is that it's filled with jaw-droppingly good action sequences. An explosion at a cafe, an attack on a car, a climactic battle scene that ups the ante on Saving Private Ryan. These scenes contain some of the greatest shots in movie history, shots so astonishing that the DVD includes a featurette on how Cuarón and his cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki managed to pull them off. Yet what makes the movie brilliant is more than technique. Working in a near-documentary style, Cuarón immerses us in a grungy, densely textured, futuristic reality unlike any I've seen on film. He doesn't recycle Blade Runner's rainy L.A. He doesn't trot out bombastically corny World War II cliches. You know, the jackbooted soldiers and Führer-style leaders you found in V for Vendetta. Instead, he offers us a lived-in world that echoes what already feels familiar. Urban terror, Guantanamo-style prisons, panic about immigrants, and a proliferation of sects and cults that can actually be kind of funny. Here, Theo talks to his friend Jasper, a doper political cartoonist played by Michael Caine, sporting shoulder-length gray hair.
Any curls?
No.
What about the one we had lunch with, Lauren?
Lorna. That was ages ago.
Well, I like her. What happened?
She decided to renounce.
Renouncers? Are those the ones that kneel down for a month for salvation?
No, they're the repenters. The renouncers flagellate themselves for the forgiveness of humanity.
Oh, right. But dating ain't what it used to be, is it, amigo?
Children of Men is one of three movies that came out last year from Mexico's so-called Three Amigos. Cuarón, Babel's Alejandro González Iñárritu, and Guillermo del Toro, who made Pan's Labyrinth. What they share is an outsider's perspective, a keen eye for social reality rarely found in the work of filmmakers from El Norte. Happily, Cuarón is too talented to bludgeon us with dead-on political ideas. While the movie does make us think about Baghdad, the war on terror, and building fences along our borders, it also alludes to Guernica and Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar. And its central problem, the infertility of women, suggests a world so far out of joint that even the French couldn't blame it on George W. Bush. That said, it's not completely accidental that the world's potential savior, Kyi, should be an immigrant refugee demonized by those in power. There's a metaphor here that Cuarón obviously takes to heart. If you think of the defining modern dystopian tales, from Zamyatin's We to Terry Gilliam's Brazil, they're nearly always steeped in defeatism. 1984 ends with Winston Smith loving Big Brother. Cuarón leaves us with something far different. For all the bleakness that surrounds him, Theo's story is a journey from hopelessness to hope. As he protects Kyi, his dead eyes come back to life. He wakes up and becomes willing to fight, even die, for something that isn't all fear, terrorism, and state-sponsored barbed wire. And though Children of Men doesn't tell us what will happen once Kyi makes her way to freedom, that doesn't matter. It's enough that she promises a better future. She's bringing newness into the world. Through her, Theo and we catch a very brief glimpse of the coast of utopia.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. You can find podcasts of Fresh Air at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Perding. Ian Chillog directed the show. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, as the first season of Friday Night Lights draws to a close, we talk with the show's executive producer, Peter Berg. The NBC series on the gritty, high-stakes world of Texas high school football just won a Peabody Award. Join us for the next Fresh Air.